We are here today with Eric Brosius, who works at Harmonix and has for the last 5 years.
About 5 years, that's right.
And he's here today to talk to us about his work at Looking Glass, and we'll just go through kind of a narrative of that and kind of segue maybe into some of how that work relates to or doesn't relate to just at your current job.
Sure. Sounds good.
Cool. So what was – I guess we could just start with a little bit of your background before Looking Glass and kind of how you got into the company. And
Sure. I'm a musician first, really, and I wasn't really – I didn't study for a game design or game, you know, or audio or anything like that. And I kind of stumbled into making video games because I was in a band with another guy who I work with now, Greg LaPiccolo. We were in a band in the 80s called Tribe, and we were kind of popular around here, and we never really did much outside of the New England area. But some of the people who worked at Looking Glass – were fans of the band, used to come see us, and then they had a new project that they needed music for. So they had two of them, and they asked Greg, my bandmate, to do music for one of them, and they asked me and my wife, Terry, to do music for the other one. So Greg did music for the first System Shock game, and I and my wife, Terry, worked on music for another game they were doing called Terra Nova Strike Force Centauri,
okay,
which was an old, you know,
robot
big shooter, kind of, yeah, 3D, yeah. You know, outdoor thing. It was actually a really good game. But, and then after a while, our band, you know, kind of broke up, and I started, we started doing a more, you know, hired as a freelance kind of audio guy to help do stuff, and after a while just kind of became full-time person.
Kind of migrated over.
Migrated into it,
yeah.
That's right.
Cool. So you started working just kind of part-time while you were still in the band mm-hmm. on, and it was Terra Nova.
That's right, yeah.
First. Mm-hmm. Could you describe a bit of your experience of, like, did you play video games before that, or was it something that you didn't know much about, you know a little bit about it, or was it like this totally different world that you were coming into?
I knew a little bit about it. You know, when I grew up, I played like arcade games a lot, you know, and I had had an Atari and things like that, but I wasn't a giant gamer at that point.
And you weren't into PC games, which is what the games you were working on were.
Right. I mean, I had played like Marathon was, you know, the Bungie game was mm-hmm. one of my favorite, you know, games early on, but not a heavy gamer, you know, didn't devote that many hours to it, you know, and I didn't really, so it was really kind of a learning experience. I came in kind of, you know, green from the whole thing, especially the sound design, you know.
So how did you approach, I guess, like, did you feel like you were in over your head, or were you just like, oh, hey, it's sound design, I guess I'll just kind of learn a bit about games, or did you just kind of like, were very intuitive about it?
Well, the first thing I was asked to do was really just music, you know, and just to write some music based on, you know, a design doc, right? Okay, these are the kind of characters we have. This is the plot that's going to be. Here's all the worlds that we have, so we need a piece of music for this world and that world and that world. And so it was really just like based on more like, oh, well, I've seen movies that are, you know, have similar vibes, so let me just try to do something like that. I also got to say that the music that we did was not that successful, and I think because one of the things I didn't really know, I think about, you know, back then we were really dealing with, you know, really crappy sound cards and a lot of FM synthesis. So I made the stupid mistake of trying to do an expansive orchestral thing that when you crushed it down to an FM card just sounded ridiculous a little bit, so... where Greg was a lot smarter than when he did System Shock, he did like an electronic score, right? Which when you translate it down to the beeps and bloops of a FM synthesis, actually work really well, you know, so it translated really well. And the work we did, we tried hard. We got it to sound good on, like, if you had an All-32, the Sound Blaster, All-32.
Yeah, I remember that, yeah.
We put our own custom samples in, we actually got it to sound really good there. But if you had other cards, it just did not sound that awesome.
Do you remember what some of those cards were? Because I'm really fascinated, because I remember having PC games at that time, and I think I had like a Sound Blaster 16 for a while before I got the Aught 32. And I remember there was like the Roland, and then there was like the Gravis Ultrasound. And
yeah,
like,
all of
like,
those.
Do you even remember that stuff?
Some of that stuff. I mean, some of the stuff was like FM, you know, based. So we had to like sit there tweaking, like, you know, doing FM synthesis, which was like, it's a pain, right? And I didn't know it. So you're just basically trying to, let me see if I can get a string sound by, you know, doing these modules and putting them together. And it was hard. And even on the nicer sound cards that were wavetable-based sound cards, we were, you know, wasn't really smart enough to know, you know, we tried to, like, do custom things. I'm going to play these, like, really cool piano notes really down low and see how they sound. Mm-hmm. And, well, they sounded terrible, you know, because they only did a couple samples across the whole spectrum. Now, on the All-32, that was one of the first cards that you could do your own sample bank. Mm-hmm. So I was able to, like, do a couple, well, if I want those low piano samples, I'll make my own, and, you know, you can upload them to the card and some guitar samples and stuff like that, which is why we were able to get it to sound pretty good there. But it, you know, it was just like not being aware of the whole industry and the whole thing that it just, you know, the music suffered pretty badly when you played on other cards. You know?
And you're talking about Terra Nova specifically.
Yeah, that one. Yeah.
So Terra Nova. So you did have the AW32 version with your custom samples and everything for Terra Nova, and you're saying that one was kind of less.
I was pretty happy with it.
I was pretty happy with that one. Okay.
But you know, it was less successful on other cards, and yeah. I think I. If I was wiser, I would have written a score that was closer to the technology we had. Mm. Trying to do something that was big and expansive on what we had was a dumb idea.
Well, but I can see how you would take that route as opposed to what Greg did with System Shock. Mm-hmm. System Shock was a, you know, a cyberpunk, and yeah. and Terra Nova was science fiction, but it was kind of space opera too. So I can imagine how you
absolutely
had thought of like orchestral.
And that my first instincts were to do that, but. Mm. I think it was my, you know, inexperience in the field that, you know, that would have been like anyone's maybe first instinct. Oh,
sure.
You know, I'll do this big thing, and you know, in practice, you know, it wasn't quite ready. There was no like streaming audio at that time. It was like this was before. Like so I remember soon after that, like not too much. Well, like MechWarrior came out or something, and that was where they had actually streaming WAV files, so you could actually do stuff in your at home. And record it, and it'll just play back these nice, lush-sounding WAV files. Well, we didn't have that, and they were not lush.
So you approached it like film scoring. It seems like.
Well, I tried to. Right? Yeah.
Yeah, and was it mostly like the missions? You just kind of had like one track. Like, was it dynamic at all? Or
it was dynamic. They had different levels of. We had for each. So the basic were they had like four basic planets in the thing, and each one of them had. A score. So, and it was all done in MIDI, right? Because we were playing back then, and each one had like they do now. They had a 2-minute piece that was like I'm just exploring. Then I had someone's on my radar. There's some tension, and then you had your combat piece, and then and so we did the basic things like you know when this game you're running around on a planet, you know, exploring, and then finally someone comes on your radar or something in the distance, and then you know you. In the battle, so we had this kind of exploring piece that was supposed to evoke the mood of the planet or something, and then when the tension level would rise, we'd pretty much immediately jump to the next section. It was all done in MIDI, so we could kind of like jump on the beat, right? We put markers in the MIDI file to show, okay, like you'd wait to the next beat or wait to the next measure,
so it wouldn't cut awkwardly.
So it wouldn't cut, you know, and then. We'd have like a timeout. Like if you entered the second intensity phase and nothing happened for a while after 20 seconds or whatever, then we would transition back to the first piece. And the way we actually did the transition, because nowadays you would like, okay, well maybe I'll do a crossfade between my tension music and my kind of normal music. Well, I actually wrote MIDI files that I basically wrote 2 MIDI files. And played and you know combined like the MIDI files from both pieces and then like crossfade them in MIDI to make them go and did kind of the math to figure out well what's the tempo difference between the first one and the second one and so that we'd actually in MIDI would do this kind of weird crossfade between you know
and was that something you hadn't thought about doing before just like for the first time because it was interactive it was just kind of like wow I guess I have to figure out
how
this works
and the thing we knew pretty much right away that if you're increasing in intensity. You can make your jumps quick, right? And almost you can hard cut them almost because you want the pow of being able to hold. But when the intensity is ramping back down, that is like as a player becoming less excited and starting to calm down, you want the music to do it like over time. So when we are ramping down to, you know, at that dial level, I would write, you know, a transition that was maybe 30 or 40 seconds long that would kind of combine the two pieces, both harmonically and tempo-wise and everything, so that you'd kind of get this, it's kind of like a MIDI version of crossfitting the audio.
Now, was it music only on Terra Nova, or was there other kind of sound design, or was it mostly just music?
I started out doing music, but I ended up doing the rest of the sound design also.
Okay. You know. So did you do like voice direction?
There was voices and sound effects and weapon sounds and, you know, footsteps and, you know,
all that. The whole sound design.
All the kind of stuff, yeah.
For the game.
Yeah, I mean, I think at that point, I think Greg was done with System Shock or close to it, so he kind of helped me get set up with like the voice recording the part of it and things like that.
But yeah, because when we interviewed him, I remember he said that he moved over to being kind of like the AV guy.
Yeah, he was like the head of the AV department.
Yeah,
and I was the lead on the Terra Nova project then. You know, so as I actually became more transitioned from just doing the music to okay, now I'm going to actually be the lead on the thing, then. I kind of took over whatever they had started with the sound design stuff. So.
Cool. So it sounds like Terra Nova was your big kind of like trial by fire experience. And so what was the next one? Was it?
Let's see. After that.
Would it have been Thief or?
No, I think we did. I can't remember. Honestly, I think we did. They did a couple flight simulators.
Flight Unlimited.
Yeah.
And there was three of them.
I think I did. I worked on like the third one because I think the first two were kind of before my time right around there. And then we did a golfing game, if you can believe it. We did a British Open Championship golf, which...
And you did music for that?
I did everything for that, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So what was that like going from Terra Nova to golf?
That was actually pretty cool because some of it was kind of the same, you know.
Oh, I mean, by that,
in the fact that... So I listen to music like, you know, that you hear like on ABC Wild World Sports, you know, or at the Olympics or other stuff that I thought was kind of like that, like, you know, Aaron Copland or something like that. So I was trying to do just music that was like, you know, it was kind of sporty, like TV, Saturday afternoon, ABC Wild, you know, Wild World Sports. And that also had the kind of, you know, I would like try to do something that felt like it was like British and ancient, because, you know, the whole thing about golf is like, well, it's St. Andrews and we're doing the old thing. So, you know, I would like throw in, you know, bagpipes or something stupid, you know, like that. So, but it was fun. It was fun because we got to do, at that point, we could do some streaming WAV files, although they were all mono. So all the music in that was, you know, kind of mono streaming WAV files.
Do you know what year that would have been, or roughly, or?
Oh, God, no.
96, 97, maybe?
It could have been something like that. 96.
I'm just thinking of I think Terra Nova is 96 and Thief is 98.
Yeah, so 97 is a good bet.
I would think.
But it was fun. No, that was I was pretty happy with the way the music came out with
cool.
that.
Cool. Cool. Was that a smaller project or didn't take as long or is that not your memory of it?
It seemed to be it was smaller. It was less expansive than Terra Nova, you know. Mm-hmm. They had a lot of VO, and that was the big thing, you know. Mm-hmm. And because they had a kind of this AI where, you know, every time you hit the golf ball, they had announcers going, and they would say, "Oh, well, I could tell that he sliced it to the left, and he's like 400, he's still 200 yards from the hole, and maybe he'll use a 5-iron." And they would cut up all these like snippets of audio. And the announcer would basically put together what he was going to say, just like on TV, based on that. You know?
So did you have to figure out how to, like, kind of algorithmically make that work? Like, who was saying what when, and, like, what would make sense? What voice cut to say next?
That had to be done, but that wasn't by me. That was one of the lead designers who of the game, his baby. That was kind of his... That was what he wanted to do. He wanted to make a game that felt like you were watching golf on TV, and so he really did all the work. We did all the recording and all of the editing and you know that kind of stuff. But he actually did all the design, so can't take credit for that.
Was it difficult to do the recording for something that was so cut up and have all these like crisscrossing ways it could be fit together, but still sound natural, like somebody's just commenting? Like, was that hard as a recording kind of directing actors kind of process?
Yeah, well, we got, like, good people. We had two guys, one guy who I didn't know who it was, and the other guy was, like, the actual my war sports guy. That, what's his name? I forgot his name. But Jim, was it his name? I forgot. But
Abe would know. He's a sports guy.
I'm trying to think. I can't remember. Is it like the actual, one of the golf commentators?
Yeah, the actual guy, Jim McKay or whatever his name. I don't know who it is. But so he would, and they, and so the, I think the trick was to record them kind of quickly. Like, you know, there was like, it was all kind of, a lot of one takes and stuff like that. And we had like at that time some kind of like voiceover software where you could just kind of, you know, didn't have to keep on typing file names. You just hit go and it would like assign a new take, a new file name. So I think a lot of it was like, you know, just kind of doing them quickly so that you don't have time to try to, there was no like, you're not acting the parts. He was just like speaking. So it kind of made it kind of easy. And then we would edit things together and then, you know, we'd bring them back in if like we couldn't.
Couldn't figure out how to connect them.
But once you figured out, when you're saying the numbers, you have to do it with this inflection, then you could say all the numbers, and they would, and as long as they're kind of the same, you would, you know, kind of do it.
Do you remember what software you were using to do the dialogue editing? Because I was doing a lot of dialogue editing for TV in 2008, and it was tedious. And so I imagine in 1997, it was probably still, it was tedious then.
Well, this was not something that would, what it would do, which I forgot what it was called actually, but it was something where you just like, once you'd like, you know, whatever, import your text file, your script basically, with your file names, every time you hit, you know, enter, it would like, it would, you know, create a new file with that file name and then, and save, and whatever, and you're done. And so you can just keep on, and that's good. Okay, so you can kind of do that. So you end up with a million. They're not, you know, tightly edited, but you have a million files that are all named correctly, which kind of helps.
Okay. So, yeah, I mean, the reason I asked about that is because I know that in sports games now, the that's become like its own, not very widely recognized art, I think, to put all those things together. Because if you play a modern sports game, that's become very advanced. The making that not sound cut together when it obviously is.
Right.
And it's just interesting to me that you were dealing with that at an early time. I mean, right. Was it your sense that not a lot of other people were doing stuff like that at the time, or were you just, or you didn't know? Or?
I actually didn't really know. You know, I mean, I don't recall a lot of games with a lot of continuous interactive voice stuff like that. They were all pre-recorded things that were story based, as far as I knew. But you know, I wasn't really.
It was also relatively the early days of recorded audio in games, period, right?
Because
it
was
like,
right.
It was like CDs were still sort of new in like 96, 97.
No, the first System Shock game came on like 7 floppy disks because you could get it without any of the voiceovers. Yeah. They're all text files. And then they also released it on a CD where you could finally get the voiceovers.
Yeah.
You know, but.
So would Thief have been sort of like after the golf game? Probably.
What I should have done is actually go, like, look at the years before this interview, because I don't actually remember.
No, that's fine.
I think so, yeah. Thief was a larger game, you know.
But you can't remember anything in between.
No, I think I did, like, so a little bit on one of the flight games. That game, I think Thief would have been the next one.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So there was, like, a few things in there, like the flight game, the golf game.
I mean, I did, like, a couple. One of the first things I did when I got there was I did a couple, like, sound effects for Descent. You know, that, remember that game?
Oh, yeah.
And
absolutely.
That was not, didn't work on the game, but it was basically, like, they needed someone to do some effects, and they sent over a list of, like, 100 sound effects, and we just did them and, like, threw them over the fence.
Yeah.
You know, just because, you know, that's what it, so.
Yeah.
It's not even, like, working on the game at all. We didn't have builds of the game or nothing. They were just like, hey. You know, because back in those days, there not a lot of studios had dedicated sound designers. You know, it was like programmers making sounds, or they'd have their buddy go out and do it. And
that's actually really interesting. So, but Looking Glass did.
Yeah,
and that strikes me as very significant because the company, at least from what I can tell, seemed to have a bit of a culture of sound being more important and having people like yourself or like Greg who were musicians working at the company. And when you look at something like Thief, of course, sound being so central to the gameplay in ways that even in stealth games now, it's not even quite as much, I think. And even going back to stuff like System Shock with the importance of audio and the storytelling and stuff, it seems to me there's something not coincidental about the fact that you have Looking Glass that has such an emphasis on sound, that has dedicated audio people, and then some of you go off to companies like Harmonix, and that's kind of interesting to me, that legacy.
I think early on, it used to be that you know, first, most companies were small, right? So they had some artists and they had programmers and a designer or two and stuff like that. But very few had, you know, sound people that were on staff, and they would either contract out the sounds. And so even when you did that, they would do like kind of what I did for Descent. You get this list, they do some sounds, they mail them to you. The programmer, whoever, would incorporate them into the game. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of the model for quite a long time. And I think one of the best things, I think one of the ways that Looking Glass was fairly forward-thinking is that they brought people in-house so that you can kind of like live with the game and absorb the game and all that kind of stuff. And then they kind of quickly took the step to put a lot of the integration abilities into non-coders' hands. So in Thief we had...
The tool set lets you do all
exactly,
that stuff.
Exactly, because, you know, like, I didn't know how to code. So, in Terra Nova, I remember, like, taking stuff, have to walk over to the programmer I was working with, and, okay, now do this. Oh, don't play it that. It had no control over volume or panning or any of that kind of stuff.
It's
like, you know, put this in, and this is how I imagine it. And you have this big conversation, and that's, you know, that worked, you know, if the guy's good and it works okay, it worked good. But...
It also takes a lot of time.
It's a lot of time, and sometimes you don't have a dedicated programmer to you. So he's like, okay, yeah, but I'm working on UI stuff, so I'm going to get to it when I get to it. And so the turnaround between trying to get stuff that you're working on is long, you know, weeks sometimes. Mm. You know. And in Thief, we developed a whole kind of just text file based editing system where the engine would basically, anytime anything happened in the game, it would spit out an event to the, you know, which happens a lot, right? Nowadays, this is what everything, but it would just spit out something to the audio engine, and then we could basically just kind of make up our own names for tags. I could tag any item with something like this, so you could, once they kind of did that, you know, I could go in and like add all the footstep sounds myself. I could go in and add all the gunshot sounds, or if I wanted to do something different, well, I wonder if I can, every time this thing appears, you know, because every time an object was drawn, they would send a create vent, right, to the sound system, and I could choose whether I wanted to hook something up to it, and there was just a giant database of it would just look up an event and a series of tags, and if something matched, it would play a sound. So
you got to, in some sense, do what a designer or a programmer would have normally done in terms of... But it sounds like that you had more authorial control over what was going on with the sound of the game.
Yeah, you would also choose, I think that we're going to play a sound here, I think we're not going to play a sound here. So for all the in-game events, yes, because they had this great tool that was kind of open-ended. And once in a while, there was something that couldn't be handled, and you have to go talk to someone. This is a special case thing, you know. At the same time, we were doing stuff like... learning how to use the level editor so that for two reasons. One, so we can actually open up the, you know, we would check out the level that an artist was working on, and I would be dropping, you know, points, sound objects, and all this kind of stuff, so you can kind of really do all the hookup of, like, okay, when you walk through this door, this is what happens, and you cross the room, what's over here, and these objects are radiating this kind of sound and this kind of stuff. So you could do the whole, all of the ambient and music in the game. We could just do ourselves without any programmer help, and I also did a lot of stuff like making test levels. Like I would build myself a room that was like 20 foot by 20 foot with all the textures that the game has, or all the styles. Like, here's the gravel, and here's the sand, and here's the grass, and here's the rock, and here's the marble, and then I could, like, you know, bring crates in there, and I could, after we hook up sounds for the physics, I'd throw them around and test them, you know. And
it sounds like a virtual Foley studio or something.
A way to test it, right, in-game, I actually wanted to, like, add these things I could try and, you know, and we could kind of, you know, because it was all, a lot of the stuff was text-based, we didn't have to rebuild the entire game to test something new. I could just, like, oh, let me tweak the values on this text file and then re-import the file
and then
run the game again. Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's better, you know.
Yeah, that strikes me as really interesting, because I know that when we were talking to Greg, it's really he was the lead on Thief, correct? Or eventually,
that's right. Mm-hmm.
Eventually,
at that time, I think he was not the audio department lead, but he was actually the project lead.
Yeah. Well, it's significant to me that you have a game where sound is so important, and the person in charge is a guy who's a musician.
Exactly.
Yeah, I'm interested in I guess maybe some examples of stuff in the game that maybe you've remembered or you thought worked particularly well, or Or I don't know. Or I don't know if that's a useful way to construct a question.
Well, I think that... I mean, you know, I'm not really that enamored or not enamored with, you know, particular sound effects or something like that because, you know, I think one thing I learned during this process is that almost anything can work as long as it's, like, placed properly in, you know, in the level. And, like, it's easier to make a bad sound effect sound good by using it correctly and... I mean, that you can kind of do where it's if you have a great sound effect that's used improperly, that makes that sound effect sound really bad. You know,
can you think of an example of like a bad sound effect?
Oh, there's a lot of bad sound effects. But I thought as a whole, I was fairly happy with like as a whole as a sonic texture for the whole game. I was pretty happy. I mean, we did a lot of things with just really short loops because again, in Thief we had no streaming audio of any kind either in that first game. So everything was really done with, you know, 5-second loops or 8-second loops, and sometimes if I needed a long one, like we did the longest one in the game, I think is there's a level called the Horn of Quintus where it's like you travel through these catacombs and you're trying to follow this sound that
the sound of the horn, right? It's kind of echoing in the caverns, right? And you're following it,
and so we needed something that was like going to play the entire level and not drive you totally crazy, you know.
By repeating too much,
right? So that was like the longest one, and that's maybe a 20-second sample, and it's like probably 8-bit, 11K, you know, it's really, you know, it's really crappy sounding.
I remember it being kind of haunting.
Well, I mean, good.
That's good.
That's good. I mean, because that was something I was kind of worried about. And the cool thing about the engine, the engine we had, Dramed, right, was the name of the engine back there. They had very good sound propagation, which means that they could place this thing, you know, 5,000 yards over here, and you do the radiuses. If the level was built correctly, and the stuff was right, the sound would actually travel, you know, snake through the things, and you could and you could hear it with the, kind of at the proper volume and kind of coming from the proper direction, and you know, we didn't have any like damping or anything, but based on texture or anything, but it would just basically all portal based. So if that door over there, if that's a door and the sound's over on the opposite direction, you know, you'd hear the sound coming through the door instead of through the wall and things like that. So that was really cool, and I thought it worked actually quite well.
I imagine some of the Thief fan community, which is, I don't know how familiar you are with them, but they're ample. They seem to be with all their levels and...
Yeah, they make their own custom stuff, and some of those are quite good. I played a couple of them early on.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they still... Really awesome. What year is it? 2011? They still use Dramed now.
It's amazing.
And they've, like, upgraded it with all this texture stuff, and, you know, I mean, they've done, like, some of them are really elaborate. Like, they've hired voice actors, and it's just...
Yeah, some of them are really good and really scary, and, you know, what's cool is that most of them, they really kind of get the whole Thief vibe, and they're not looking. Most of them are not looking to turn into something else. They're just trying.
I mean, the tone and the atmosphere.
Yeah, whole visually and, you know, sonically, everything. They're trying to just like keep it going further, rather than try to change things. It's kind of neat.
No, that is interesting. So when you were, I'm a little bit interested too in the, I guess, the kind of artistic direction for the game, and from a sound point of view. How, I mean, do you feel like there were kind of other people leading that direction and you were just kind of following it and trying to, like, do justice to their concept? Or did you have a strong concept yourself of what that sound was? Or, like, were you really following the visuals or the writing or et cetera, et cetera?
There wasn't really a strong concept other than the things we were keenly aware of were that this is going to be the first game, the first... kind of stealth game that was really going to rely on audio cues, and so we put some kind of like stakes in the ground. Like we didn't want a typical music soundtrack, you know, one that so because in a lot of games, most games you have like okay, you have a sound effect bed and an ambient bed and everything. And then you have a music soundtrack that kind of goes on top, you know, and like a score. And so we kind of didn't want that. because we wanted to make sure there was enough space in the game so that you could kind of hear what's going on. That being said, I also wanted to make sure that every inch of the game had audio in it, and there wasn't any kind of silence. So, and I think I learned one of the lessons that I think is one of the most valuable lessons to me is that kind of a less is more type of thing. Because a lot of the the ambience in the game, they might just be like a 4 second loop that drone that just is kind of going for a while, and nothing else might happen for a little while. And it sounds really dull if you kind of think of it that way. But in the game, I sort of found that it kind of almost like hypnotized you and kind of sucked you into what you were doing and made you very aware because of the simplicity of what you were hearing, very aware of stuff around you. So, which worked in your advantage for like listening for your guards' footsteps or your enemies. And also, anytime we added a new piece with just a hint of music, you know, you'd really notice it. Yeah. And I think that people, I've heard comments, you know, from people saying, talking about the music as if there's like some big score. And I'm like, what are you talking about? There's nothing. It goes like this for a while, and then you get this one note. And it's almost like people use their imagination, you know, because you've kind of like stripped away everything down to something that's really simple. So so that part I was really interested in. And you know, as I was like actually going and trying to put sounds in levels and trying to play through them and see how things go, I think I quickly learned that this is going to work for this game, where, you know, we can just try to keep it simple and hypnotic. And like we didn't really try to make it scary, or didn't try to make it dramatic or whatever.
It is scary.
But I think it's scary too.
But that wasn't the conscious.
It wasn't really a goal.
Yeah.
But we wanted to make it, we knew that we had to make it really immersive. And I think it ended up working by having kind of simple sounds that almost kind of lulled you into this like hypnotic state. You kind of like started really paying attention to your surroundings, both visually and orally. And I think that it's one of the main reasons that the game works sonically.
That is a really good explanation of something that I was trying to articulate in my head earlier for a question. But I think that is, now that I think about it, yes, that is really interesting, because I remember when you talk about this ambient sound, it's really striking ambient sound, right? It's not like the kind of ambient sound I feel you hear in a lot of games, which is almost unnoticeable. It's just something so you don't have silence. But this, like the sound of being in, I think, like in the first level, you're like, you come in through the sewers, you know the instant you get to the first floor, because you walk through a door and suddenly the whole ambient soundscape is different, and I think you're right. It does create that experience of it makes you suddenly stop and think, whoa, what's in here?
Right.
And then you start listening for what else you might be hearing aside from the ambience.
And because we didn't have a kind of proper musical score, we took liberties with the ambience. Like the ambience are sometimes like realistic things. Oh, there's, you know, crickets and there's wind and there's like leaves rustling. There's a lot of that. But there's also just like, oh, I'm walking around inside and there's this weird drone going.
No, exactly.
And
yes,
like,
yes.
And
yes.
That's not really a realistic thing. That was kind of the music, but functioning like the ambience. So we really were blurring that line, trying to consciously blur that line between ambient sound and music, so that they kind of became the same thing.
Because it is ambient sound, but you use it like music.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways. And I have a very strong memory of downloading the demo back when it was just called The Dark Project, I think before it was even called Thief. And I remember the... it's kind of funny because Thief is famous for, you know, it's kind of like big emergent levels and nonlinear and all that kind of stuff. But the cutscenes are great. I mean, it has these really focused, like really wonderful cutscenes that just like completely nail the feeling, right? It just like sets you up for the feeling and the atmosphere that then the levels kind of deliver on.
I think that's true, and I think that I'm glad to have played a part of that, but I think a lot of that is the visual design and the right. They had these really cool quotes, you know, in the front. They would have these like prophecy type of quotes, and they were all pretty cleverly written. They were really, you know,
well,
smart. And then the art was kind of simple, but you know,
oh no, it's
pretty
wonderful.
Awesome, you know. We knew we wanted to have this kind of, you know, they had the whole kind of like, that's the term you hear a lot, steampunk kind of thing, right? Which, you know, it's like old-fashioned, but heavy machinery, stuff like that. So immediately, you know, we wanted to have some sort of industrial type of elements, you know, but we knew that we're not going to have kind of industrial music in the game, you know. I think we had debates about this. I think there were people on the other side who were like, this doesn't fit the game at all, this kind of like, you know, louder, you know.
The final piece you're talking about that's actually in the game. There was some debate
final,
about
yeah,
that.
Final, you know, guitar feedback and yeah. you know, fuzzy, that doesn't seem to, with the larger beat and stuff like, doesn't really seem to fit. And there was some, you know, it was kind of polarizing, you know, because it was not in character. In fact, like, we'd always have this, whenever we would do a trailer or something to try to advertise the game, we would sometimes use similar type of, you know, kind of more aggressive music. And then we'd have, you know, well, this doesn't really, you know, kind of tell you what the game's about because the rest of the thing is kind of like at a pace that's slower and more deliberate. So, but, you know.
That's a really interesting dichotomy to me, though. I mean, there's nothing wrong with having tonal variation, right, in the game. It's like the game gives you this, like, awesome advertisement for itself, and then it kind of gives you this world in which you sort of have to live up to that music. You have to somehow create that sense of coolness for yourself just through how you behave in the game.
And we would try to use, like, I would also try to use, like, some of the elements from that intro in other places in the game. Like, I had, there's some levels where I would, like, cut up a bunch of guitar feedback that I had used in the level into small pieces, and they would kind of play as, like, ambient sounds, the same way you might do a wind loop, you know, but they would just be, like, these things that would kind of crossfade and, you know, or... There's some kind of like bell tree sound that's kind of like a shaky ritualistic kind of sound. I remember using that in other places. So, as much as possible, I mean, I was a big believer in like reusing stuff. You know, if I had something that I used over here, what can I do over here and play it backwards or pitch it down six steps or make it stereo and play the left side backwards? You know, I think that A, it's just an economy of resources,
sure.
And B, I think that it helps stitch these kind of disparate things together in some subconscious way.
Yeah, I was about to actually say subconscious because it does give you a kind of a subconscious continuity between something on the surface which might not seem related, which is that kind of hard intro music and then the kind of ambient sound design of the game.
An interesting thing that kind of happened to me as we were talking about like spareness and kind of like lulling you in, hypnotizing you, I think that... In the later Thief games, like I did the second one and the third Thief game also, and in both of those, we had...
The third, which was not Looking Glass.
No, the third one was done right.
Iron Storm,
right. Yeah. But I did that one also, and you know, by that time, we could stream stuff, so a lot of the pieces were kind of, you know, two-minute, still the same thing, like you try to blur ambient and music and stuff like that. But there's something about them being like larger loops that were more kind of thoughtfully put together that was nice in a way, but also I think took away in a way and didn't give me the same quite that I didn't think they lulled the player into the game as effectively as the first one.
I think that's really interesting because I'm thinking about modern sound design approaches and how not everybody is thinking about trying to have coherence to the entirety of their sound design, right? It's, I need an explosion, I build an explosion, and I put it in, or I need this gun, and I put it in. It's not how do I create a sonic world that works. And it's really, I think it's really great to hear that, you know, whatever, you know, 14 years ago now, right? Like people, like, inspired somewhat by the technological limitations as well, right? But you're working, you know, on trying to develop a coherent sonic space. Because I think we'd have better sounding games if more people thought that way. And so,
or more unique. I mean, I think the idea is that, like, you can, like, take a random clip of Thief, you know what I mean, and kind of recognize it as Thief,
sure.
Where it would be harder to take a random clip of...
I mean, I think some of the... You know, I think that a lot of games nowadays have awesome sound, and they're way more advanced, and they are really, really good. And you know, like, some, once in a while, like, something will remind me, and I'll go, like, and I'll go run through some of the old sound effects that if I just click on the wave, I'm like, oh my god, that is so terrible. How did I actually let that go into the game? But I think that, so the thing that saves it is on a whole, there's this kind of,
sure.
you know, thing
sure.
that like makes them kind of fit together and neither, almost no sound in the entire game is very important, but hopefully they come together in some, unique is good, because that, I think unique is one of the most important things that we get to miss, right? We all, as movies are, like, so sophisticated and stuff like that, everyone has this, like, you know, great composer writing this great music, and you know what? You can't help but they all start to sound the same, right? Even if it's really, really awesome, it sounds the same. And
They're all Hans Zimmer, right? or somebody else. Yeah.
And games are kind of like, as in the last, like, 10 years, all games are now orchestral things, and they go rent this orchestra and they do that. And it's really awesome.
And
the
it's
music
good.
Is
it is good.
Really getting good, but we're starting to suffer from the same things. There's not that much unique, you know. You know, so it's nice when you see, like, Limbo come out, right? Okay, different approach. Not only does it catch your eye visually, but sonically it's also, wow, this is focused in some kind of way that makes you remember it. You know?
Yeah, absolutely. Do you have any other sense of, like, games that you like for stuff like that, or stuff that's, like, jumped out at you in like, the past 10 years, maybe? Or?
You know...
just out of curiosity.
You know, I... the Half-Life games were awesome. They were kind of like a pinnacle of like, you know, of that kind of stuff. And you know what? I have to admit that I don't play games very much anymore.
Oh, that's fine.
And so I'm not. I'll play some demos, and I will have friends, and I will watch them, you know, play games like that. But I don't actually really play, you know, a ton. You know,
you didn't play Limbo, it sounds like.
I did play Limbo a little bit. I mean, not a lot. You know, I didn't finish the game. You know, I mean, I played Halo when it came out and blah, blah, blah. You know, and I played Silent Hill because that was kind of up my alley. I like, oh, this is going to be a good, scary game. So,
you also did System Shock 2, is that correct? So how did that come about? Because I know that that was like a joint Irrational. Irrational was just starting, and then that was... So you didn't do System Shock 1. That was Greg mostly.
Right. I did... Greg was the chief guy on System Shock 1. I mean, I helped doing some of the audio logs, you know, and I helped do, like, a lot of the localization logs, but I wasn't a sound designer or didn't write the music for that, you know. I was.
But you did on 2. So you were, like...
On 2, yeah. I was the guy, yeah.
Okay. So as opposed to the Thief series where you were sort of, you know, where you were, like, the author of the sound experience of the game, you were kind of... Do you have a strong sense of, like, trying to kind of begin where Greg had been in a certain way, or was it very more just kind of like, well, this is a different project?
No, we wanted to, it was funny, we wanted to keep, you know, first of all, it was built on the Thief engine, it was using the drama. In fact, it was built in the Looking Glass Studios because Irrational was there, but they had moved into some offices right, you know, right where we were, and they were sharing the same tech as, I think, as we were making Thief 2, I think they were making System Shock 2. So, and part of the deal with them being there was that they would use some of Looking Glass's folks. So they used some of our tech team to help, like, keep on polishing up the engine. And maybe, I don't remember if they used any artists or something, but they used Looking Glass's audio department. So, we wanted to keep it like System Shock, but bring in some of the elements of that the Dramat engine did well, like, which is the whole, a little bit of the stealth thing. Now, you know, System Shock's much more of an action game than Thief was. But I remember having one conversation that lasted about 20 seconds with Greg, because he was kind of there, and we were thinking about whether we should re-envision Shodan's voice, you know, or not. And so we were like, okay, so should we, this was a big part of System Shock 1, should we kind of progress and change and try to figure out what the next evolution of how she should sound? And then I think we talked about it for like 20 seconds, and we're like, no, fuck it, no, this has got to be the same. It was so cool the first way, we're going to try to do it exactly the same. So one of the things that we tried to do a direct copy of is, you know, when we did voice processing for System Shock 2, we tried to copy the same, we tried to make Shodan the same, you know, exact voice in the first one because it was so cool. You know?
So that's really interesting because when we talked to Greg, one of the things he talked a lot about was how hard it was to create the Shodan voice because he had to do all those stutters by hand because of the sound technology of the time. And I'm wondering, So for you trying to recreate that same thing a few years later with different technology, I'm wondering how that process was.
It was exactly the same because I had done some of that on the the French and German version on the first one. So I knew how the because they're all hand done, right? Hmm. All like, and we back then we set them up. Back then we for the first System Shock, I think they used DEC, which is like an early four track, DAW basically, mm-hmm. right? So, I kind of knew because I didn't do the English ones, but I did some of the French or German Shodans, where we had to like cut up stuff and because they all had to be done separately by hand too. So I kind of knew how it was done, and we actually did. It was exactly the same, I used Peak for System Shock 2 and Digital Performer, but it was exactly the same, basically, You bring did some processing on the voice to get it into the kind of character, distortion and some doubling to kind of make it sound like a mechanical voice. And then we would cut up and, just try to like listen through and find places we thought we would stutter it just by copy and pasting. And it was just like a lot of like, okay, let's take this line and pitch it up a lot and stretch it out and do this and pitch it down. And, maybe add a second one that like echoes what you said. The idea was basically, I like the idea that whenever she was talking about something that annoyed her, we let her spin off a little bit. Like, so if she was talking about the intruder or something, she might go, she couldn't spit it out, and it would like come out in a burst. And then when she's just talking about normal stuff, maybe she would calm down. So try to make it, but it was the same done by hand. In fact, I remember talking with Ken Levine, and because Ken Levine is an awesome, awesome writer, but he likes to write and rewrite, And so, we said, I'm not doing any of the Shodan processing until the script is completely locked, because it took 2 to 4 hours per line to chop up and turn it into.
How many lines total, you think?
For the Shodan voices, 150 something.
And that's just Shodan?
Just Shodan, yeah. The other ones, like the regular, the other logs, like the logs that you hear just from the crew members, they were, they had to be, put together also, but they were not nearly as complicated. It was just basically, you batch convert all the things so that they have a certain tonal quality. And then for different crew members or different decks, we'd have different ambience that we put behind them. And some were really orchestrated, like maybe in the log, there's some firefight going on, so you'd have to do kind of almost an audio post to this fictionary movie, so those we could kind of do early on, but the Shodan ones up until the last couple of weeks, all the Shodan lines were just my wife she recorded
all the way,
so it was just her speaking, the parts normally. She can do that creepy, hello, how are you doing?
Yeah,
like the
howl voice.
The female howl voice that seems just like, because there's something, and even there's something about, where the human cadence is slightly off, like the pitch goes up maybe at some time where it shouldn't. So she can do that really well, have it.
So she is performing it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She is, although all the stuttering and all the crazy stuff that happens is done after the fact, but it works a lot better because she knows how to just the dry read is creepy because it's like slightly unnatural because you can tell it's a computer speaking to you because they know all of the rules of language, but they don't have any of the connotations behind it. And so that, the pacing and the timing is slightly different. So she can do that really well. So,
yeah, I was going to ask you before, but it sounds, I think you already answered it, which was, what was the primary driving thing, concern for when you were doing the pitch ups and all this kind of stuff? And was it just like what sounded cool, or was it about the character? And it sounds like it was largely about the character in a lot of ways. Like it sounds like you had a very strong sense of who Shodan was. Like this is a very clearly defined character.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't really that, a strong sense, but not really that complex. It wasn't like there was, I couldn't write pages on it or anything like that. But, but the general sense that this is someone who is not alive, but thinks they are all powerful and thinks they are in control, but really aren't. It's like some haywire. They're dealing with, it's almost like a computer dealing with being born, right? They have all the infantile you know, things that a baby has, right? Because they don't know, they don't have like the maturity, the judgment around the world. So
she throws fits,
yeah. And we whenever her line had something that I thought she's probably annoyed at this or irked, or she's mentioning her nemesis, then we would try to like, you know, doctor up her voice in a way that made her sound like she was losing it for a second, and then she pulled it back together because she's trying to be this perfect human. So it was all like, you know, I think that the one thing that we struggled with in System Shock 2, a lot of the Shodan lines were very instructional. They were actually the thing telling you what to do.
Because in System Shock 2, Shodan deceives you by pretending to be somebody else,
right.
and then is sort of like your guide. And
but
then,
even after she's revealed,
she's still your guide.
She's still your guide telling you to do this. So in System Shock 1, I remember listening to a lot of logs that were, a lot of them were like insulting, you know, nice jump, human, and, you know, things like that.
Oh my God, I remember that part
of the game. And so those were sinister just by what she was saying. I remember struggling with trying to make things sinister when it said, okay, go to deck 5 and press the yellow button and you know, the writing was, I don't mean to imply the writing was dry. It wasn't dry at all.
No. Yeah,
however,
yeah.
But there was a lot of instructional stuff. You know, first you must do this, then you must do that. And that part was like, okay, I'm trying to find creative ways to keep her in character without her having flip out, you know, about something stupid. So it was kind of tricky to try to keep the same intensity going when she's actually not yelling at you or calling you an insect.
And it sounds like the sound design otherwise for the game, because it was in Dromed and it was very Thief inspired. Was there more kind of focus on ambience in
System Shock 2? The thing that was different is that we did have, because this was more of an action game, we did have like a separate musical score from the ambience, you know, and that you could turn off in the...
That was very different from Thief.
Yeah. You know, now a lot of the ambiences we did were still atmospheric, or not like non-realistic, you know, hums and thrums and things like that. Mm. But because the world was also so much denser, we got a lot of
than System Shock 1 or Thief.
Than Thief, excuse me.
Okay,
meaning there was like there's computers everywhere, there's buzzing lights, there's stuff. We had just a lot more stuff to
like technology in the world as opposed
to
Thief.
So we would do, you know. We try to come up with some cool sounding little loop of bleeps and stuff that was kind of creepy and hook that. So you had a lot of that. So System Shock 2 did have a separate score, and I didn't actually write the music. Most of the music for System Shock 2 it was written mostly by Josh Randall, who I work with. He wrote most of the kind of faster techno style stuff, and by a guy who had just started at Looking Glass named Ramin. Jawadi, who actually is now in Hollywood. He's done like, you know, music for, I think he does music for the Game of Thrones HBO thing.
Oh, wow.
And he worked with Hans Zimmer for a while and is kind of working his way up the chain and actually doing his own movies and stuff.
Oh, wow, cool.
And he did a lot of the kind of more slower, creepy music. And
more something you might more associate with horror. Kind of.
Yes, right. And so... I contributed a few pieces of music on my own, but mostly I took their stuff and did some remixing and integrating into the game and laid them out into the levels, you know. But we definitely treated it as a separate thing that you could turn off if you wanted to. So we had this thing where we were trying to make the ambiences. If you decided to turn the music off, we still wanted the ambiences to evoke enough atmosphere that you felt.
But you still can't turn off the ambience, is that correct?
You can't turn off the ambience in this one, no. But you could turn off the music like you can in most of every other game, you know.
Okay.
And then we had, you know, we had a lot of people just loved the music. They thought it was really awesome because it actually is really cool.
Yeah.
But we had some purists who were like, oh, no, it's getting in my way of, you know, my Thief-style exploration, which, and I can kind of see both points. But
So it sounds, because some fans were sort of encountering it, because a lot of people didn't play System Shock 1, so some fans were encountering it as kind of an extension of what they knew from Thief, and some people were encountering it as a sequel to System Shock.
Exactly, yeah. And some of the people, you know...
So it's kind of both, too, right?
It is.
It's kind of like a Thief offshoot and also like a System Shock sequel.
Yeah, I mean, right then, we you know, we were just coming off... Thief 1, and we were like, you know, we liked all of the, we thought that kind of like, wow, the fact that you can kind of hear what's going on and have those be cues, that's important. Why drop that for this game? You know, we want that whole thing. You know, part of System Shock 2 is also sneaking around, and a lot of the AI for the guys who are your enemies is very
the creatures
similar,
and mutants and robots and stuff.
Is very similar to Thief. So if you stand still, they won't notice you, and you know all the kind of same stuff that you could do in Thief, you could do in System Shock 2. That wasn't really the central part of the game. It's much more mm-hmm. action oriented. So a lot of people didn't even realize that if you just shut up, the guys will probably walk right by you. You know.
But it still works because
it still works.
It's still in the system.
Yeah,
yeah. It inherits a lot of that. One of the things I've been asking people and obviously, and I mentioned before, you know, working at Harmonix now, being you know famous for being a sound music oriented company, is there anything? I don't know if the best way to even articulate this, but anything you learned or any of your experience or how you think about sound over the course of your career, like how does that transition in any way into what you do in Harmonix? Like, do you see that as connected with the stuff you were doing at Looking Glass, or do you see it as more of kind of a different thing?
The stuff at Harmonix is, you know, quite a bit different. You know, we're usually dealing with music-centric games, which means music is up front, you know, and sound effects or atmosphere is less of a thing, right? And we're usually dealing with licensed music in most of our games, which means that we're not even, like, writing, you know, evocative things. It's about something different. So there are, I think there are a lot of differences, of course. But experience from doing the other kind of more traditional games, you know, Thief and System Shock and stuff, of course, you know, teaches you about all the other, I mean, we still have sound effects in our games, mm-hmm. But the approach is quite different. I think that it was quite different for me. And as soon as I kind of like came to Harmonix, I remember like, oh, I miss kind of doing kind of sound in a 3D world and things like that, you know. But dove into other stuff. You know, we did a lot of, obviously with Harmonix, we do a lot of like transcribing and, you know, trying to turn. This music into these kind of abstract, you know, things that kind of try to represent the music as best we can mm-hmm. on the, even though they're not real transcriptions, and that was kind of a challenge and a good way of thinking about it. But I'm not sure how directly. I mean, other than the general experience of like kind of.
Well, I think maybe what I'm wondering is, I guess I'm struck by the. By maybe the culture of a company like Looking Glass, where you have these people who are musicians in positions of guidance. Mm-hmm. Is there a similar vibe at, I mean, obviously there would be at Harmonix, and I'm just interested in sound being important, mm-hmm. not being the last cog of the, you know, of the engine, is something that I would imagine is even more emphasized, probably more at Harmonix than probably almost any other company. But it does seem like I don't know if "got started" is the right word, but it definitely, I would imagine there's some carryover from the experience of a company like Looking Glass, where that was also extremely important.
Yes, I think that's true. I mean, we have there are a number of people from Looking Glass who work at Harmonix, you know, and a number and some of them, you know, are kind of musicians first. You know, even some of the coders are actually musicians first, and they go and they play in bands and stuff like and that. So, yeah, I think you have this. There is this, you know, certainly this mentality that you know, that sound is never just the veneer, the polish that we put on top at the very end.